Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Michigan Law in Chicago, joined by my co-host, Rob Hunt of Lanay Holdings out in San Diego. Rob, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Larry. It's good to be back, and nice to see you.
Well, thank you. You too. And last week, we hit the first of the days between on Jerry's birthday. Today is the final day of the days between on the day of Jerry's passing. So if you thought we were going to be doing a lot of talking about Jerry today, you were right. And Dan, could you please get us started with our first clip of the day? Rob, if there's a song ever played by the Grateful Dead that's more symbolic of Jerry than Deal, I don't know what it is. That's one of my all-time favorite Deals from Alpine Valley in July of 1989, the first night of their final three-night run at Alpine Valley before they shifted to Soldier Field for the last 5 or 6 years there. But I love this song, and I think that's a great clip. What are your thoughts?
I've always been a huge fan of that Alpine version, and I think Heady version actually even rates it as the best Deal ever played. It's nice to know for all the people that didn't think, you know, the Grateful Dead had all this fire at the end of the 80s, early 90s. I challenge them to listen to that Alpine Deal and revise their opinion.
Well, I think you're right, you know. And look, we're talking about Jerry today, so let's just cut straight to the chase. A Grateful Dead show, in my opinion, 99% of the time is going to rise or fall with Jerry. If Jerry's having a hot night, people are going to talk about that show forever. It doesn't matter what they play. If Jerry's having an off night, they're going to find everything in the world to bitch about. And I know because I was there for plenty of hot nights and just as many of the nights that weren't quite as hot as we were hoping for when we walked in the door. By the way, on those nights, we still had a hell of a lot of fun. So I don't want to make it sound like it was a negative experience or anything. But when Jerry comes out, you know, and he's just on fire like he was for that entire Alpine run. And we're going to be hearing more from that run in a few minutes. When he's like that, it just takes everything to another level. And when you have a first set closer like a Deal and, you know, Jerry's on top of it and he's just jamming away. The intermission just, you know, seems to fly right by because, you know, you're all hyped up from what they're doing and you're just ready for them to come out and tear it apart in the second set, which they typically did at Alpine Valley. You know, I think one of the things we're going to see today, Rob, in the songs that we play from Jerry really hits on this theme, you know, trying to find examples when Jerry's not just playing good, but he's sounding like he's having fun. And there's, you know, a little dance step in his feet, if you might say, you know, the jelly knees, as we all like to call it with Jerry. So we'll be getting to that more in a few minutes and all of that. And hopefully our listeners will go along for the ride and see how we support our good friend Jerry Garcia today.
Yeah, let me jump in on that, too, because, you know, that Alpine Valley Deal is from, I believe, what, July 19th, 1989. If you go back two episodes and we had Tim Seymour on, the deal we played from that night was July 4th, 1989, which I think is the second most popular version on Heady version. So it wasn't just that Alpine run that they were fired up. It was all of July, that 89 summer tour. Was you know, pretty stellar all the way through. I mean, I saw, I want to say, the Giant Stadium shows that summer, and they were as good as anything that I saw ever. So that whole 89, they're just rocking. They're just crushing it out there. But obviously, that was a good time to see a Deal.
No doubt. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, it can be very insular for us sometimes, right? If you see a show at Alpine Valley and they're crushing it, like, oh, that's, you know. But when you look at it from the more global picture, which a lot of us can do now in the, you know, the last 20 years, thanks to the availability of all of these shows, not that we didn't have them all on tapes before, you know, as you really get a chance to, you know, to focus on some of these and just really hear the way Jerry takes it. And you're right. You know, you look at the entire 1989 tour, and I think it was, you know, an interesting time for the Dead, an interesting time for Jerry health-wise and everything else. But they were on fire that year. There's no doubt about it. And Brent was up to his best. And, you know, we've already talked about, you know, his career winding down shortly thereafter. But, you know, it's you know, on a day like today, and we're, what now, 27 years out from Jerry's passing, which is basically impossible to believe, but true nonetheless.
But don't you think that like that whole 89 period, part of the reason it was so hot is because that was when Jerry was like really getting into playing with the MIDI and was like really excited about trying something new out. So that's when we were getting all the horn sounds and all the clavinet sounds. Yeah, you saw it, especially in the fall tour of 89, but summer of 89, he was definitely kicking it in. But that was, you'd hear it on Foolish Heart. You'd definitely hear it on the other one. You'd hear it on all sorts of things. And I think anytime, like, you're a kid with a new toy, it causes you to get excited about trying new things and experimenting with new things. And, like, a lot of times the best work you get out of any musician is when they found their muse or found inspiration in something new.
I think that's an excellent point, and I will be the first to admit that I don't have nearly the technical knowledge of the instrumentation and the things that they have up on stage. But, just even as a more a practical approach to that, from a guy who just, has always enjoyed being there, and looking at what they had on stage and looking at the changes in instruments and setups and everything they had over the years, there's no doubt that a guy like Jerry, I think, would be enamored of something like that. And, again, it makes me wonder, what would have happened to the whole Dead scene and the whole Dead experience had it come along 20 years later, and hit right in the middle of this whole explosion of the internet and everything. I mean, can you imagine? It's impossible for me to imagine not being inside a Dead show and literally knowing as the show is going on, what they're playing and what's happening, and, or to be able to just touch and say, hey, I wonder if they ever played this song before, and go to the internet and pull it down. That's just a long way of saying I agree with you. And I think that it does show that Jerry was very happy for a lot of reasons. But let's talk a little bit about Jerry for a minute here. And you, I wanted to dig up a couple of things to talk about today. And this is why it's very important to have partners when you do podcasts, because I was all set to go diving into a topic that we had talked about a couple of weeks ago. Rob successfully reminded me of that and was even nicer to come up with a few articles that all share a theme, which is the straight world and its new bromance with Jerry Garcia. And, I think it kind of started right around the time he died, and just gradually got stronger over time. And now it's like full out, flirtation, right? The one I love, just for starters, Rob, is the Empire State Building being bathed in psychedelic lights in honor of Jerry.
Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, first of all, the guy that does the lights, the Empire State Building, we've known for quite a while as a Deadhead. So it's not surprising to me that he's done it. And if you think back to, Fare Thee Well a few years ago, they actually coordinated the lights on U.S. Blues while it was being played live in Chicago. They're, having the lights dance at the Empire State Building in time to that U.S. Blues being played live. So that gives you a sense of just kind of like, what camaraderie you have with the person that does the lighting. But I mean, look, the lighting of the Empire State Building is probably one of the most iconic lightings of anything in the United States. The only thing I think that comes close is when the Bay Bridge in San Francisco was doing like their art experimentation and was doing really, really funky things over there. But, nothing like kind of stands out. Like when the Rangers win and you get like a red and blue, Empire State Building, you always know like what's happening based on what the lights are doing in New York. And it gives all New Yorkers a sense of like what's going on in the world.
My favorite one, just to throw in there, was when M&M's announced that their new color was going to be blue. They announced it by the lighting on the Empire State Building. And I thought that was very cool of them.
Yeah. The only thing my kids wanted to see when they got to New York was the Statue of Liberty and the Empire State Building. That was it. Even as 6 and 7 year olds, you understand like the iconic nature of that building. But to have August 1st lit up where the whole city got to see it, not just in one color, but as you said, in psychedelic, sort of tie-dyed fashion, was a one of the coolest homages you could pay to Jerry. And I think the other one that I love that happened on August 1st was the mayor of San Francisco dedicating August 1st as, the Jerry Garcia Day in the city of San Francisco. So, Strasbourg has Mozart and, San Francisco has Garcia.
Absolutely. And the truth of the matter is the town should be known for that. And it's a moniker and a connection that they should proudly associate with. And I'm sure Jerry proudly associated with him himself, in his own way. But, who wouldn't want to take advantage of something like that? And, for so many reasons. I mean, we already, those of us that have been on the bus and in the scene for a while, I think, instinctively think of the hate and Jerry and all of that. I mean, to me, it kind of always comes down a little bit to, what do we think of Jerry and how do we think of him? And I know, Rob, you and I have talked about the fact that, a lot of the Garcia family members are not big fans of all of these Deadheads who treat him, some sort of an idol or a god or anything like that. And while I can understand why that would be difficult for family members, You know, if somebody thought my dad was a god, or even worse, somebody thought I was a god, my kids would really have a good laugh about that. You know, but by the same token, Jerry was who he was. And I just like to think of him as the coolest hippie out there, who really knew how to entertain the crowd in a way that we all wanted to be entertained. And he had an image, an aura, a persona that at least my instinct on it always was that he would be a really, really fun guy to sit down and talk with for a little while. He'd be a great guy to sit down and smoke a joint with. And, you know, that's about as much of a, you know, fan statement as I ever wanted to make about Jerry, because, you know, there's always the concern that what if they turn out to be assholes? But I don't think that was the case with Jerry. And, yeah, you know, it's just wonderful to see. If the city of New York feels it on a big enough level, good. That's just more love for him going around.
Yeah, well, the flip side of that too, Larry, is would Garcia actually welcome all this attention should he be alive? I mean, if you think about from the perspective that he didn't even go to his own Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction because he didn't want the fanfare and other things that he was invited to. It was rare that he made an appearance away from the Grateful Dead to do something that, you know, was not, you know, musically related. The only ones I can think of that are kind of like outside of the ordinary is when he and Vince and Bob went and sung the national anthem to open the San Francisco baseball season, right? Yeah. So it is really rare. But I mean, I know that they talked about like putting a postage stamp out of Garcia that, you know, he was against, and he made fun of it when another country actually did it for him, saying like, it's bad enough I've got to see my face in my own head every day. So, you know, it's hard to say whether or not he'd appreciate the fanfare, whether or not the humility that he had would have downplayed this. But I will say for the San Francisco inauguration there, Trixie was front and center. She was there accepting, you know, sort of the key to the city and the monument. So I think the perception from his kids of how he was as a father back in like the 70s and 80s versus how he is remembered might be a little bit different. And, you know, things change with time. And I think they probably appreciate the love and reverence that people have for their father.
Well, I hope you're right. And you just said something a second ago that really resonated with me. And I'm glad you said it, because, you know, one of the things that I really wanted to harp a little bit on this today is, while how, you know, the whole world has fallen in love with Jerry, but they only after he died, right? None of this was happening while he was alive. And we'll talk about MLB in a minute, and, you know, other groups that have welcomed him. But maybe it just had to be that, you know, there had to be a, you know, until after he died. Maybe it was something that either people instinctively felt, or he let be known, or, you know, that it wasn't, you know, maybe you're right. I don't know that he would necessarily want to be around and see the statue of the Empire State Building, you know, bathed in psychedelic lights in his honor. You know, for all of us, we think, wow, how cool. We love Jerry. What a great thing. But if you're the guy yourself, I mean, you know, we saw the documentary, and we know the load he carried around with him, certainly in his, you know, in his later years, you know, to you know, try and live up to his reputation and his, you know, the plateau and the pedestal that all his fans had put him on. And it proved to be too much for him or any normal human being. But I, you know, either way, I think the Empire State Building is great. I think the city of San Francisco is great. And it just kind of cracks me up that like every Major League Baseball team around is having Jerry Garcia Day, including the St. Louis Cardinals, I might add, which is certainly fun. I've got my Cardinals, you know, Jerry Garcia Day tie-dye t-shirt, and I wear it, and it's all great. And, you know, but that also just strikes me as a little bit funny, you know, an interesting connection. And in that same vein, I note that during last season's football playoffs, on the advertising bumpers going in and out of playing time, they were constantly playing a lot of Grateful Dead clips.
Yeah, I think that's relatively common now. I think that a lot of the major sports leagues are doing that with, you know, and again, a lot of that comes down to whoever it is at the network that's choosing the music to go in and out. And I think a lot of those guys are kind of jam band people. So whether it's, you know, catching Widespread Panic here and there, or catching Fish here and there, or catching, you know, like a handful of other bands where if you know what you're listening to, you're like, ah, that's that, instead of playing mainstream music. But, you know, maybe we should get back to a little bit of the music and understand why people are celebrating it right now. And I think you picked out a great clip, one of my all-time favorites, coming from March 18th, 1995, from the Philadelphia Spectrum, which is one of the most playful Ico Icos I've ever heard, where like the sort of the call and response that was coming at the end of that song was so fun. And, you know, people forget, just, you know, again, we've talked about the iconic sort of like Creole or Caribbean nature of Ico and of Women Are Smarter. But, you know, sometimes it's fun. It's always fun. But sometimes it's really, really playful. And I think what you picked out is definitely one of the best. So you want to cue that one up, Dan? I know.
That's great. And, you know, for people who didn't have a chance to see him play it live, it was always a fun tune and it was always a great tune. And it would always be right at the last, after the last verse, the last time around, you know, when Jerry would do the multiple hey nows. And, you know, I remember on average, it would usually be about four hey nows. Maybe on a good night, you'd get five or even six. But this night, he just went on and he did it softly and he did it loud and he did it playfully and he did it sing-songy. And this is 1995, man. Everybody talked about, oh, after, you know, the mid to late 90s, the Grateful Dead had it. This is Jerry Garcia a few months before he dies up on stage having a ball. And you can watch it on YouTube under a clip of examples of Jerry dancing on stage and see how much fun he was having.
Yeah, I got to say, like, this is one of the songs that made me fall in love with the Grateful Dead when I was 15 or 16, because, like, the heyday of Ico's was probably, like, 85 to 88. And that was, you know, for me, right when I was getting into going to see them. And, you know, as I was getting to the point where I wanted to go see them because I was familiar with a lot of their songs. But Ico is one of the ones that, like, really got me enthusiastic about the band in general.
No doubt. You know, I always talk about September 82 Syracuse Carry Dome, my second show ever, as being the one that firmly got me on the bus when I was there with my good buddy Mikey. And, you know, I went and I listened to that one last night because I was trying to decide what Ico to pull. And, you know, to me, in my mind, of all the Icos I ever saw, that's my favorite, probably because it was the first time I ever heard it. Probably because the mushrooms had long prior kicked in. And, you know, it was the first time I was just really experiencing it for, you know, for what it was. And I went back and listened to it. It comes out of space and it's a beautiful Ico and it's really, really good. But even that one at the end only has about four or five call responses before it's all done and over. But no doubt that night hearing that song, and you know, my Dead knowledge was still very limited at the time. It was only my second show and I had never heard of Ico before. And I just was instantly taken by it and decided I have to go see them every time, if not for any reason, just to hope they play Ico.
Yeah, I think the best one I ever saw, I think you were probably at the show as well, was 6/20/1991 from Pine Knob. And that Ico was spectacular.
Yep. That was a good one as well. And, you know, and I always like to remind folks, the first Ico ever was in St. Louis and it was like one verse and then they immediately dived back into Not Fade Away. And I remember hearing that a long time ago and somebody said, oh yeah, here's the first Ico. And I'm like, but they're barely playing it. Well, they were just experimenting. But I do take pride in the fact that they played it in St. Louis, you know, for whatever that's worth. So it is a great tune and it is always fun to hear Jerry play that. And like we say, especially to know that, you know, if you look at the timing of 95, it's just nice that you could go to 10 shows in 95 and maybe he'd be flat. But if you're at that show in Philadelphia that night, it was all worth it just to make it there to see him at that moment shine like that.
Yeah, I think it's fun. I mean, look, the part of the whole thing with the Days Between is really just focusing on the music of Garcia. And again, like I know we're the Deadhead Cannabis show, but, you know, we can talk about cannabis all the time. I think there's a couple weeks a year where it's really fun just to go, okay, let's just talk about the Grateful Dead and let's talk about the music of Garcia. And I know it's a bit cliche to do it during this period, but you know, at the same time, it gives us an opportunity to you know, pull out gems and pull out, you know, different things from different eras that we didn't necessarily do in other shows where we're trying to be more topical on a specific person or a specific date. But, you know, being able to just throw things out from a whole range of shows, like we've gotten a chance to do that a couple times in the last few weeks, and it's a lot of fun. And I think you've got some other really fun ones queued up for us, which would include some tunes we never expected to hear Garcia play. So until 1995, you know, I don't think anyone in the Grateful Dead community outside of, you know, the people that actually got to sit in club front or in his living room, got to hear him play. So what do you have queued up for us next?
Dan, go ahead. We talked about this one last week. Go ahead and throw this one on, Dan.
Some take delight in the carriage of rolling. Others take delight in fishing and bowling. I take delight in the fruit of the barley. Caught the pretty women in the morning so early. Wash your lamb, you are done. Whack for the daddy-o, whack for the daddy-o, there's whiskey in the jar.
What is the name of that?
Whiskey in the Jar, it's
whiskey
called.
Whiskey in the Jar.
That's the song that has that I Am a Bold Deceiver in it.
Years ago.
Yeah, right. I haven't heard that one in 30 years.
Yeah, no. Right, I haven't either. I just remembered it.
The whole song, words and all.
Whack fall the daddy-o.
Whack fall the daddy-o.
Right. Daddy-o. It's got great lyrics. It's
God,
a cool song.
Stuff.
Yeah, it's a cool song.
Yeah. I guess that's Irish.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me just say that that's the essence of Jerry Garcia right there. You know, we don't get to see it. It's back in private with his guys. And we all love his music, and I know you've talked about this a little bit, Rob. I've talked about it from time to time. We try to go back and see all the musical examples that ultimately built the foundation that, you know, Jerry based all of his music and playing on. It turned him into this walking encyclopedia of music, that there he is with the Grateful Dead rehearsing in 1993, and out of nowhere, he just starts playing some tune that popped into his head and, you know, chats about it for a minute.
It's turned us into a walking encyclopedia of music, Larry. It's not just Jerry. He was a walking encyclopedia, but as a result of his encyclopedic knowledge, it's made, you know, other people like ourselves delve into all sorts of genres of music that we never otherwise would have. I mean, originally it was just delving into specific songs of specific artists, but then, you know, that takes like a rabbit hole turn of its own, and all of a sudden now you're listening to, you know, Irish shanties, you know, that you would never otherwise listen to because you know, like somehow you got turned on to it. And I can tell you that I remember very, very distinctly where I was the first time I heard Whiskey in the Jar and the first time that I heard the So Many Roads kind of compilation CD. And it was up in Eugene, Oregon, and there was like 10 of us traveling in the back of a Suburban for a friend's wedding, and we were all kids that used to like go on tour together. It was kind of one of the first reunions after Garcia's passing. And that song, like where we all sort of were stunned because half of us had heard it and half of us hadn't. And those of us that haven't were like, what the hell is that? And like, everyone's like, yeah, you haven't heard that yet? It's amazing. Like, and it just completely sort of brought us back into that moment of like being back on tour together. Instead of like mourning the passing, it was like celebrating something new again for once. It was such a great feeling.
I completely agree. That's why you can go back and listen to Garcia forever. And even stuff that you've heard before, if you haven't listened to it in a while and you pop it back in and you're like, God, that's right. And as much as I loved listening to him sing, I'm not going to lie about it. I would pay money to listen to the entire conversations that he has during rehearsal, just the talking part of it, you know, to get a chance to hear him talking unguarded, you know, and kind of unreservedly with his buddies, the way you and I were talking, even the way we're talking right now. I can't get enough of that, you know, and that's the part really on top of that. But the other thing about Whiskey in a Jar that we do just have to point out is, you know, Garcia was not unique in the musical world in covering it. You know, we even went so far as I believe Aerosmith gave it a cover as well. And not to diss Aerosmith, who was always one of my favorite, you know, 80s, you know, kind of East Coast grunge bands that just came and jammed it out all the time. When Garcia plays it, he plays it with the Irish melody. He plays it with the Irish lilt to it. He knows how to pronounce those words, and you know, he can sit there. It's like he's sitting in Ireland and just decided to pick up his guitar and start playing a tune.
I've never heard the Aerosmith version. I've certainly heard the Metallica version, but I know a lot of other people have covered it. And we talked about this previously. I don't think most of them covered it until after it came out on So Many Roads. So I'd like to say that, you know, whoever revived it first was probably Garcia. That makes me wonder. I mean, it's strange that a lot of people seem to think that if you're a heavy metal player, you only listen to other heavy metal bands. You know, if you're a jam band person, you only listen to jam bands. You know, that maybe it's because most fans only listen to a certain genre of music, but most musicians have much broader catalogs of what they listen to. It's just a question of what they enjoy playing. And so, you know, I'm curious to know whether or not, you know, Steven Tyler and Kirk Hammett were, you know, big fans of Garcia's, and we're listening to it going, hell, that's a great song to cover as well. Let's get after that one.
Yep. And I think you're right about that too. You know, sometimes one artist covers a tune and all the other artists hear it and they thought, wow, never occurred to me to play that. And, But yeah, I think the way you also said it before is absolutely right. You know, for Garcia, this was knowledge he already had. You know, for the rest of us, it's a serious learning experience. But on the other hand, I make myself feel a whole lot better by saying that the guys who were sitting there in the studio with him were basically learning it at that moment as well. And, you know, again, that's just the beauty of him. You know, songs like that would pop up. Another one that I'm thinking of, and maybe this is the one I'm thinking of that was covered by Aerosmith, Walking the Dog, right? That's just a very standard bluesy tune. And for a while there in the mid-80s, the Dead picked it up and they were playing it. And, you know, that these aren't the kind of tunes that you typically see bands going and picking up, right? They tend to play other bands' tunes, maybe within their genre to some degree. But the Dead just explored everywhere. We've talked at length about Dylan, and we'll even get to Dylan, I think, in our next musical clip in a minute. But, you know, something fun like Whiskey in a Jar is good.
But I think Aerosmith actually may have covered it. And I know other bands like, you know, Slade covered it, and U2 covered it, and who else? Thin Lizzy covered it. Like, there's a handful of bands that that covered it as well. So I'm not...
And a lot of those bands are hard slash bands, you know, and may just fit into their whole idea of drinking whiskey. I have no idea. But yeah, look, the more the cover it, the merrier, right? It's like, who was it? The Harsh Mellows who covered Ripple on the Grateful Dead compilation. Or no, Guns N' Roses. No, not Guns N' Roses.
No. Jane's Addiction.
Jane's Addiction. That's what I meant. And, you know, if you listen to it, you're like, what? When you listen to it two or three times, you're like, that may be my favorite version ever of that song. It's, you know, it's somebody else covering it, and it's great to hear. So,
but speaking of which, you know, there's some great interpretations that you expect other people to cover. And one of those is obviously Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan's probably the most covered artist of all time. It's amazing to me, like, how many songs that, like, you can't pick a Dylan tune and not find someone that's played covers. But even if they're, you know, part of the obscure part of his catalog. But on the ones that I think of as, like, the most iconic, you know, it's hard sometimes, like, to do it real justice, because, you know, you're covering someone that's so iconic to begin with. And it's kind of like the idea of, like, you know, Jimi Hendrix covering Watchtower. Like, you know, was that going to fly? And he was able to do it in such a great way. And once in a while, you know, Dylan will tell you, like, there's people that cover his songs better than he does it himself. And I think that the Garcia band specifically covered Dylan songs far better than Dylan played himself. And I think, you know, the Grateful Dead covered, you know, at least 10 or 15 Dylan tunes as well. But of all of those, if someone were to ask me on any given day what my favorite song in the entire world is, you know, it vacillates back and forth between four or five, and has for about the last 10 years, but more often than not, I'd say it's Tangled Up in Blue. And I think that the Garcia band version of it is, you know, absolutely the reason why I'm so enamored with the song.
I cannot disagree. I mean, but even Dylan's version of it, and even with, you know, Blood on the Tracks, he still has his voice pretty well, I think. But it's a little more halting in the way he plays it, because it's played in that Dylan style that's always kind of herky-jerky as he goes along. And Jerry just took it and truly made it into a melody the way he plays it. And you know, as you'll hear here, the problem with Tangled Up in Blue is I started listening to it, trying to find, you know, about a minute of time to clip. And every time I thought I had a minute, right at the end of that minute, they do something else. Well, I got to get that in, and I got to get that in. And finally, I was running out of tape there, so I just kind of settled with where he winds up with it at the end. But far be it from me to tell anybody what's the best part. I would just go listen to Tangled Up in Blue, the Jerry Garcia band playing it as many times as you can. And this version that we're about to hear is off of his the JGB band's double live album that came out in 1990. So, Dan, spin this one for us, would you please?
Thank you.
just the stuff that he's doing with his guitar, you know, and there's 5 minutes of that guitar solo with him playing it on a high octave, on a low octave, back and forth and all around. It's just amazing.
It was always the song that would close out a second set also. So when you think about, like, you know, how you were leaving the show, you know, once in a great while, you'd get an encore out of Garcia Band, you know, maybe play A Wonderful World or something like that. But 9 times out of 10, you're either getting Midnight Moonlight to close the show or you're getting Tangled Up in Blue to close the show. And both of those would send you out, you know, feeling pretty high about the night. But Tangled Up especially, like, you know, I'd say it was for every 5 times I saw Midnight Moonlight, I might have gotten to see one Tangled Up in Blue. So, you know, it was kind of like the treat of like, oh, tonight's a Tangled. And it was like it never failed to deliver. It was always so much fun.
It is a great tune. And I do love Tangled Up in Blue. I do love Midnight Moonlight as well. In fact, the very first time I saw them, I saw Midnight Moonlight. And I was talking to a friend afterwards. And I was like, you know, I'm really bummed. I wanted to hear Tangled. He was like, dude, you heard Midnight Moonlight, man. That's one of Garcia's best tunes. When he jams on that thing, it's awesome. And it is. It's a fun, fun tune. And that's the beauty of Jerry. It doesn't really matter what he's playing, right? There's a million covers of stuff. You know, go ask somebody to sit down and pick up their, you know, their 5 favorite versions of Jerry songs. It's impossible. I was on YouTube and archive last night for hours, just long after I had picked the clips I wanted to play, just listening to all the other ones that were out there, because how can you not?
Yeah. I mean, I could have picked 15 different Tangleds and, you know, and been happy with the choice of every one, which we've done before. You know, we've covered specific songs and said, you know, here's, you know, 10 different versions of it. But with Tangled Up in Blue, like, I mean, first of all, that song was built to have backup singers. Second of all, it was built to have major, like, melody overlays musically done the way Garcia does. And the best part about it is that he lets John Kahn and Melvin and I think at the time it was probably David Kemper playing drums just really keep the song going. And then he just, like, jams completely and totally over what's already really energetic and just, you know, as you said, takes it high, takes it low. And that's what makes it so much fun.
Yep, and that's the beauty of seeing Jerry. He doesn't have to answer to anybody but himself. And, you know, on those nights, you know that whatever you're getting is, like the label says, pure Jerry. And, I mean, you know, not to diss Deadheads who say they go to the show for Bob or if they go for Phil or they go for anybody else, because they're all integral and I love all of them. And it wouldn't be the Grateful Dead without any of them. But if it wasn't for Jerry, I don't know that the Grateful Dead, you know, would be the Grateful Dead. I think they'd be, you know, a very, very good rock and roll band. They'd be very creative, you know. And maybe they'd go the way of Moby Grape or Quicksilver Messenger Service as time goes on, you know, without his musical influence. And again, I don't mean to say that to diss the rest of them, but I just think it's hard to imagine that, you know, Garcia and his energy and his spirit is just not the ultimate driving force behind everything that happens with that band.
Yeah, I agree. And sometimes it's on like the super energetic level and sometimes it's on the very mellow level. And, you know, one of the things we got out of Garcia in the later part of his career was the introduction of probably 3 or 4 really, really like interesting slow tunes that that became, you know, in retrospect, some of his most iconic songs, whether it was Standing on the Moon or The Days Between or So Many Roads. You know, those were the three that were probably released, you know, from 1988 or 87 forward that just made a huge impact. But, you know, So Many Roads didn't even come out as a song until 1992. It had 4 years of play. And in those 4 years, you know, I can think of 20 versions that are simply just absolutely amazing. And, you know, for that reason, there's a lot of soul in that song and a lot of what's the right way to say it? Emotion that's put in the song that, you know, people resonate with after his passing. And I think the one that, you know, everyone looks to as the version, and that, although I don't think it's even close to the best version, it might be the most soulful version, is from the final night the Grateful Dead ever played, which is July 9th, 1995. And, you know, I've got a special story about that one. I'm sure I've told you personally, Larry, but I probably never, you know, said to the audience. I didn't get in that night. I was at Soldier Field, and I didn't have a ticket. And I thought I had a ticket until, like, 20 minutes before showtime, and things happened. Someone else ended up with my ticket, and I ended up getting shut out. So I was standing outside the venue, and at the time, you were able to get, you know, kind of right up to the fence line of the venue. And I knew where, like, all of my friends met during set break. And so I stood outside where that gate was by the Greenpeace table. And I was able to get my girlfriend at the time to come out and give me the car keys to her car so I could at least just go, you know, lie down, take a nap, whatever. And so, like, security guys thought I was trying to, like, sneak in. I was like, no, I'm just, you know, trying to get the car keys, and, you know, spoke to them in a really, like, positive way. And about 10 minutes later, just as the Shakedown Street started the second set, this guy walks out and he's like, hey, do you want to go into the show? And I was like, yeah, I'd love to. And he's like, all right. So he takes me. I was like, whoa, you serious? And he's like, yeah, man, follow me. And I followed him. We walked like through the hallway and we started walking down the stairs and he kept getting me closer and closer to the floor. And I was like, oh, nice. Thanks. But, you know, and this is a ticketed show. This wasn't a GA show. And then he walks me onto the floor. And as we're walking, every other security guard saying hello to this guy. I finally look at him and I was like, you know, what do you do at Soldier Field? He's like, I'm the head of security. And I'm like, you're kidding me. And he's like, yeah. He's like, look, man, like you're the only person that wasn't giving me a hard time all night. You're being super cool out there. And he's like, you're up in front row. And I was like, I probably shouldn't say this, but yes, I have been, you know, but for general admission shows, I've never been front row for a ticketed show. And he's like, well, let's go. And he just kept walking me up. And by the end of Shakedown, I was front row for the final show, and I stayed there through the Samba and the Rain. By the end of the Samba and the Rain, I decided to walk back, so none of my friends were there, and I knew all my friends were in the back of the floor where, you know, all the seats had been pretty much ripped down. It's just an open floor pit back there. But I walked back and started telling the story right as the So Many Roads started. So whenever I hear the So Many Roads, I always think back to that night, and thank you to whoever was the head of security at Soldier Field on July 9th, 1995. You know, but for you, I would have not seen the Grateful Dead's final show, and I only saw half of it. But I listened to the rest of it from the, you know, just outside the venue. But I actually got walked in and got to hear what's now considered to be kind of like a legendary performance of So Many Roads, and specifically because it was, you know, the final night. So I don't know if I've ever told you that one before, Larry.
No, that's a great story. And you know what? It's perfectly fitting for a guy like you who was such a hardcore Deadhead. It's perfectly fitting for the Grateful Dead. And it's absolutely perfectly fitting that was the last show that they ever played. And, you know, I think that's wonderful. And that's, you know, a great renewal to the spirit, right? That even like in these cities where sometimes law enforcement looked at the Dead with, you know, slightly askance, you know, at the end of the day, I think they really did know deep down that the Deadheads were the ones who they most enjoyed having to deal with, because the Deadheads, other than, you know, getting stoned and sitting quietly, weren't fighting with people, weren't, you know, crawling all over everyone, weren't, you know, causing fights and, you know, improperly touching women or the kind of stuff you'd see at a lot of other concerts, not, you know, notwithstanding the fact that there were certainly people outside the fence at a Dead show who could be very rude and obnoxious, and you demonstrated the stupidity in behaving that way for them. Look, that's a great story, and it's wonderful that you got in. And to me, the highlight of this So Many Roads is, I think of stories, it's situations that I've experienced with older relatives and stories that other people have told me about older relatives, whereas the relative gets closer to the end of their life and, you know, sometimes even right before the end of their life, they oftentimes experience, you know, like moments of clarity and moments where they snap right back into it. And maybe, you know, some event can kind of bring them back in and center them for a little while. And, you know, although none of us obviously knew at the time that, you know, what was in store for Jerry within a month from the date of that show, looking back on it, you know, I can't help but wonder if, you know, somehow he himself didn't know that, you know, perhaps things might be coming to an end. And, you know, what I call an otherwise, you know, more or less forgetful Jerry night, you know, the Black Muddy River encore was enough to first time ever to get me up and starting to walk to the exit during an encore until Phil saved the day with the tour ending box of rain and a little sunshine for everyone. But, you know, that night when they're sit there playing and all of a sudden he hits into this song and it's like he just cut through all the fog with a knife and he stepped to the front of the stage to play this tune. And it was like he was there, 100% of them, the guitar, the singing, the emotion. And, you know, again, looking back on it, you know, it almost brings a tear to my eye, because I really wonder if he said, you know, no matter what else happens tonight, I've got to leave my mark with something. And this was the moment that he picked to do it. And it's just incredibly special.
Yeah. And before we play the clip, I apologize. I'd said that I was up there for the Shakedown and the Samba. It was actually the Shakedown and the Samson, and the Samba came after the So Many Roads. So brain fart there. But
for those keeping score at home.
Yeah, exactly. I like to make sure I'm accurate if I can be. But yeah, it was Shakedown, Samson, So Many Roads, Samba.
Okay, let's hear it.
So many roads.
Okay, so first of all, that emotion in his voice is exactly what we were talking about earlier, right? Jerry just catching the fire, catching the spirit, and you hear the crowd react off of it. You know, this is more than just Jerry. This is Jerry giving it that extra effort, and everybody's loving it, and he's got it cranking, and then he just brings it down and just leaves you. Like, instead of having to jump off at the end of the song from the 10th floor, he brings you right down to the ground floor and just leaves you there. And it's you know, gives you chills hearing it because it's a great song. He plays it beautifully, and it's the last time he was ever going to do it.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, there's other versions I like better for, like, the pure, like, sort of soul of what you were just describing. March 27th, 1995 from the Omni in Atlanta. If you haven't heard it, it's a version that, like, I don't know how more people haven't, like, picked up on this one, but it's probably one of, like, the most iconic versions I can think of in terms of, like, just Jerry basically almost in tears when he's singing it. And then the other one in terms of pure energy, I'd say, is September 18th, 1994 from Shoreline Amphitheater. And that one is right when they started doing the Ease My Souls and then the Jam, and then they bring back the Ease My Souls, you know, towards the end. So, you know, it used to just be that you'd get the So Many Roads to Ease My Soul and then the Jam, they'd end the song. But then they started, you know, doing the bring back the same way they did with Stella Blue and the same way they did with Standing on the Moon towards the end. But yeah, this July 9th version is unbelievable, especially because it's the only time we ever sort of just stopped completely. It was like, Lord, I've been walking down that road.
You know, yes, and it is just so wonderful all the way through, and the emotion that he brings to it, and the way that he plays it, and, you know, the way that the band supports him, and it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful tune. It really, really made a big difference for all of us that night who were there, both in terms of, you know, our enjoyment for that evening in and of itself, and then, of course, you know, when we found out the significance of that evening about a month later. When we lost Jerry, and it's a wonderful thing, and you know, that comes right at the very end of their career, and for the next clip I've got Dan keyed up for us, was a standard from the very beginning days of the Grateful Dead, and then took a very long vacation, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 756 shows from December 31st, 78, until the Dead resurrected it the first night, July 17th, 1989, of that Alpine Valley run. And I believe July 17th is the show featured in the Downhill From Here video that the band released. But this version of We Bid You Goodnight is wonderful, not just because, you know, the Dead are bringing it back for the first time in a number of years, but because, like with a lot of the songs they brought back for the first time in a number of years, they actually took some time to rehearse it. And they're really, really on top of it. And, you know, you can hear in this one, too, both not as much musical, but certainly in the way Jerry sings and his little chant in the middle of it and his preaching, if you will. And it's absolutely wonderful. It was amazing for me to get to hear it. You know, and you just tell right away how special and significant it is. I was there with a lot of good buddies that night, and it did not disappoint. Dan, can you play that for us?
Said the creed for the beast at the ending of the woods. Good night, good night. And he ate all the children that would not in the woods. Good night, good night. I remember right well, I remember right well. Good night, good night. Good night. See for the ark that wonderful boat. Good night, good night. We're walking in Jerusalem just like John. Good night, good night, good night. Lay down, my dear brothers. Lay down and take a rest. I want you to lay your head upon your Savior's breast. I love you. Oh, but Jesus loves you the best, and I bet you good night.
Wow, you know,
it's as close to a true gospel song as the Grateful Dead ever played. You know, they're like Garcia, you got a lot of gospel, the Garcia band, but with the Grateful Dead, you know, like you had some parables, you had Samson, you know, you had a handful of others, but you didn't actually have like true gospel. And that's, you know, that's the only time they did it. And it was one of those things that they only brought it back a cappella. They only brought it back, you know, from 89 to 95. And, you know, the thing that's so amazing to me about it, Larry, is that they did take such a huge break with it. But they still played the Bid You Goodnight theme at the end of Going Down the Road. You know, like as Going Down the Road ended, you know, the jam they'd play, especially in like the mid to late 80s, was the Bid You Goodnight jam. And the thing that's so cool about it is, you know, you kept hearing it. And if anyone that knew like the song, you know, while listening to Going Down the Road, you're like, why don't you just bring back Bid You Goodnight? It just makes so much sense to do it. And I think back to like 3:31:88 from the Brendan Byrne Arena and the Going Down the Road from that night, and just how thematic the jam is at the end as a Bid You. And then, you know, a couple of years later, they brought it back, the next year, and then played the sort of like the staple version of it, I want to say on 10/16/89 at the Brendan Byrne Arena. Super, super cool. But it's one of those songs that I was super pleased they brought back. And I can't think of another like true a cappella song that the Grateful Dead played.
The only other one that comes to mind is Addicts of My Life, right? I mean, I guess they kind of turned that into an a cappella tune a little bit at the end. It was typically played, at least on the record and everywhere else, with a little bit of music behind it. But yeah, I mean, clearly, you know, this was that song. And, you know, to hear just Jerry, you know, belting out one biblical verse after another there, you know, you can imagine being under revival tent and, you know, he's up there leading the charge. And, you know, I don't think it's surprising that the Grateful Dead had a lot of followers who had strong religious beliefs, certainly among the Hasidic Jewish community and the more religious Jewish people. He was very popular. I met people from, you know, every religion and every background at Grateful Dead shows. And, you know, whether it was Buddhists who came in because they loved his message of peace and the way he communicated it, or anybody else, he had that spirit in him. And I truly believe that, you know, certainly during my Grateful Dead years, although I, you know, wasn't, you know, giving up on my own underlying religiosity, if you will, the Grateful Dead, I don't want to say they were a religion because I think that makes it sound wrong, but they were a spiritual experience for me. And, you know, when I was at a Grateful Dead concert, when I was with fellow Deadheads, it really felt like a community, like a congregation, like an organization of like-minded people who were just, you know, all in the same place at the same time, because what was happening up on stage touched us in a way that we felt compelled to be there.
Yeah, I agree. And I always think that's the major difference between, you know, sort of the way that you approach like real sports fanatics versus real music fanatics is, you know, both of them will spend all their income that they have, disposable income, like pursuing their passion. But the difference is between like sports and music is I don't think you have that same like true joy that you experience. Like for sports, it's binary. You know, someone wins, someone loses. With music, it's not. Everyone there is winning. And that's something I truly enjoy about it. And, you know, that's why I like had to go see as many shows, and people are like, you're ridiculous. You're going to see the Grateful Dead over 100 times. And I'd be like, well, you've seen the Yankees, you know, 200 times. What's the difference? You know, like for me, the difference, I truly enjoy the outcome either way.
Right. That's an excellent point. And I remember reading an opinion piece years and years and years ago, right when I first started seeing the Dead, that compared going to a Grateful Dead to going to a baseball game. And it talked about the traditions and people sit in the same place and people keep score, whether it's keeping a scorecard or keeping track of all the songs. And you could see 100 Dead shows and then go to your 101st and see something you've never seen before. And, you know, just like you go to a baseball game forever and one day walk in and see a no hitter. You don't know what you're getting until you get there and you see it. But you're absolutely right. At the end of a baseball game, half the people leave happy and half the people leave sad, and taking the entire market, not just necessarily the home crowd, but right? Grateful Dead show, everybody walks out happy. The band is happy. The people are happy. Hopefully law enforcement is happy because everybody was really mellow and had a good time. The promoters were happy because they made lots of money. The local community is happy because all these Deadheads spill out and spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on post-show gas and food and water and everything under the sun. It was just this amazing, amazing community.
And this is where we can bring the cannabis into this show today, Larry, which is all the weed dealers were happy. You know, we certainly made a lot of money in the lot. So, you know, that for a long time, that was where the best, you know, cannabis in America was disseminated, was on the Grateful Dead lot. And, you know, like the guys that I knew early on that were doing things that are now, you know, pretty well mainstream today, you know, that was the place where, you know, you could always find, if you knew who to talk to, the absolute best weed in America, no matter where you were in America. So, you know, the weed dealers, you know, the earliest days of the cannabis industry were certainly, you know, happening on the Grateful Dead lot.
You're absolutely right. And to me, it's more than just the presence. To me, cannabis is integral to the Grateful Dead. You know, and some might say, well, hallucinogenics and all of that. And yes, I mean, you can certainly make an argument, certainly when you're in the primal Dead period, that hallucinogenics did fuel a lot of that and put them where they are. But I think my knowledge maybe on this is very limited. But my understanding is that some or most of them, or a few of them at least, you know, continued to smoke marijuana, you know, throughout their whole career. And I think for many, many people that were turned on to the Grateful Dead, a lot of times it happened when you were sitting in a college dorm room or your big brother's room, and, you know, you were smoking marijuana for the first time, and somebody said, well, if you're going to get high, man, you got to listen to the Grateful Dead. And all of a sudden there's this connection. And you know, maybe it's because when you're high, you know, your brain is tuned in a certain way and you're picking up, you know, the notes that Jerry's trying to send you. We always used to joke as to whether, you know, Jerry was talking to people on two different levels. You know, I'm playing one level of my music for the folks that are tripping and the other level for everybody else so they can just enjoy it and have a good time. And one of the best lessons I learned over the course of my Grateful Dead career was that I could go to a Grateful Dead show without tripping and sometimes without smoking even and still have such a great time. And that's, you know, really what struck me was that the marijuana might be part of the gateway process to get you in the door. The marijuana might be part of the process that helps you really first enjoy it. But after a while, the marijuana just, it's there and it's just a part of it. And you know, that's the beauty of it. Where else in America, and I had this conversation with my son, can you walk into a building that has police all the way around it to keep people without tickets from coming in and to keep people from breaking the law? And the minute you walk through the doors and you sit down in your seats, and really the minute the lights go out, it's as though you've been transported to a different place and the local rules really don't matter. And as long as you don't get out of line and you don't hurt anybody and you don't do stupid things and all you do is sit in your seat and take one hit or smoke a joint, they don't bother you. People are getting high in the Auditorium Theater in downtown Chicago in 2010. Chicago is one of the most strictly enforced no smoking ordinances in the country. And people are in there getting stoned and nobody lifted a finger to stop them. And how could they? You know, when you book a Grateful Dead show, you're getting the whole bundle with it. This is what happens. This is what people do. And yes, marijuana is inextricably linked to the Grateful Dead. And again, not that you can't have one without the other, but when you take the two combined, right, like matching up the color scenes in The Wizard of Oz with Dark Side of the Moon, right? When you put the right things together, marijuana and the Grateful Dead, it takes you amazing places.
Yeah, and I think that that's been shown time and again by how many guests we've had on the show that have been very tightly related to the Grateful Dead community that are also just fantastic cultivators. So it's you know, a lot of the great brands, not to mention that, you know, Mickey's got a brand and that Garcia's got a brand and Big Steve's got a brand. I mean, there's a lot of people that are part of the direct Grateful Dead family themselves that that, you know, have their own cannabis brand at this point. So it's clearly inextricably linked between the two. And it just shows that the two are kind of made for each other. I mean, I can't remember who said, but there was someone early on, Larry, that said to us when I said, hey, let's. Oh, it was David Gans when I called into the radio show and I said, yeah, we've got the Dead of Cannabis show. And they said, oh, that sounds like peanut butter and jelly. Those two are made for each other.
True. And again, you know, David Gans, who turned us on to Terry Haggerty, who, you know, it fits this description that you just described to a T, right? And that's who he is. He's a guy that's deeply connected to the music and deeply connected to the whole, you know, vibe and feel of marijuana. And a number of people that we've had on our show, you know, who have all expressed, you know, the not just, oh, I like getting stoned, but the change it's had on their life and the impact it's had on their life. And I have said it and I'll say it again, that certainly in my case, I think that, you know, the moment that I discovered marijuana and to some degree the Grateful Dead right around the same time really changed the arc and the direction of my life and where I what I did and what I wound up doing and what values were important to me and which ones weren't as important to me. And it certainly shaped my life. And, you know, I'm very comfortable in knowing that, you know, some degree, it's also helped shape my kids' lives. And, you know, I'm very comfortable with all of that. And I think that there's just so many benefits here and so many positive things. You never hear people having negative experiences with the Grateful Dead, meaning with the music and the band itself, not the idiot sitting next to you who has too much to drink, right? And again, if you're smoking your marijuana responsibly and you're smoking it at home and with people, you know, who you enjoy and whatever, it's a very positive thing, and it brings out the good in people. We all talk, oh, we sit around and giggle. Well, yeah, you're giggling, but why are you giggling? You're giggling because you're in a happy place. It's taken you to a place where, you know, human beings like to be, where we're hardwired to be. You know, I think the Grateful Dead and its music exemplifies that as well as anything else that could.
Well, I will definitely bring that to my dinner conversation tonight with former guest of ours, Alex Beard. If you remember Alex, artist from New Orleans, but I'm having dinner with him tonight.
I do.
So, yeah, so that should be interesting. And we'll definitely talk about painting and cannabis and the Grateful Dead. So it should be fun. And I know he'll send his regards to both you and Dan.
Excellent.
So your last clip, you know, let's talk about it for a second, because like, look, this song is one of the songs that for years and years I could never really, you know, get a beat on what it was all about. And then, you know, sort of one day it just sort of clicked for me. And, you know, I was just sort of thought of it as another slow encore, the way like A Knockin' on Heaven's Door was, or the way An Addict's was, or Black Muddy River. But in many ways, Brokedown is a much more complicated song than that. You know, it's a much more complicated song. Like, and I'll tell you, one of my favorite things out there is on 10/31/1991, during the Dark Star, when Bill Graham had just passed away and Ken Kesey came out and did the rap during the Dark Star. And it's, you know, about as heavy as it gets when Phil Lesh is just thumping away on the bass. And Kesey's talking about after his son had passed away that the Grateful Dead, Bill Graham had sent money up to put a signpost up that would show the direction on the top of the hill where his son was killed in the car accident. And then he starts talking about, you know, when the Grateful Dead play Brokedown Palace, you know, they're telling me about my son. And if you haven't heard it, that Dark Star is one of the heaviest things the Grateful Dead have ever done, thanks to Kesey getting up there and doing the rap. But you know, that when I heard that rap for the first time, it caused me to go back and really listen to the words again to try to figure out what Ken was talking about there. And Brokedown is like, outside of like some of the best harmonies the Grateful Dead play, outside of like, you know, just, you know, some really fun, like, iconic single lines that everyone likes to sing together in unison. It's just an absolutely stunningly beautiful song.
Well, you know, with you having said that, I guess there's really not a whole lot more to say about it. You're right. It's an amazing song. It's a beautiful song. You know, I always took it to be a song about, you know, on a more simple level, a guy breaking up with a girl. But I think when you stop and you really look at it deeper, at least when I do, I see it as a guy coming to peace with the fact that maybe his time on earth is ending. And that's the relationship that's ending, you know, that's what's happening. The relationship that you have with either your God or with other people or with the earth while you're alive. And that it's a song speaking out to somebody who may be going down through that journey. And I heard it for the first time in 1982 at this Syracuse show that I've talked about with the Ico and everything else when I got on the bus. And after this absolutely amazing show that ends with a Sugar Magnolia that will always stick in my brain as one of the finest, and sitting at the very back end zone of the Carrier Dome with the Grateful Dead over 100 yards away down at the other end and seeing an entire sea of people swaying back and forth with Sugar Magnolia and just knowing that this is what I was going to do, they came back out and they played this version of Brokedown Palace that started off rather lighthearted because they were playing a joke on Bobby, and somebody came out and announced that it was Bob Weir's fifth wedding anniversary and they had flown his wife out from somewhere, and you know, we all out there chuckling. And then they dive into this version of Brokedown, and it really hit me because A, it's a beautiful song. And you know, the message that it conveys is really big, but B, although I didn't know for sure, cause it was only my second Dead show, I kind of instinctively knew this was the end of the concert. And I felt like Jerry was saying goodbye to me. And it was a night that I did not want to end. I wanted to be there forever that night. I wanted that show just to keep going on and on and on. And when it was over, I was walking outside, we were getting in a car and we were driving back to somewhere else, and it wasn't inside a Grateful Dead show. And it really hit me hard. And you know, to be able to go back and hear it now is great. And, you know, quite frankly, I can't think of a better way, you know, to end our show and, you know, to show our love and respect for Jerry and to really say goodbye to him, than by playing part of this clip. So on that note, thank you to everyone for listening today. You know, as you can tell, I think from the way Rob and I were talking, you know, this is a real act of love that we do. Most of the time we're talking about the Grateful Dead within the context of the Grateful Dead. And that does include Jerry, obviously. But I think that one of the best parts about the Grateful Dead was their efforts, including Jerry's, to emphasize the importance of everybody else in the group. But once or twice a year on his birthday and the anniversary of his passing, as Rob pointed out before, it does seem appropriate and the perfect time to take a couple of minutes and just focus on what an amazing person he was, an amazing musician, an amazing band member and bandmate. And just an amazing part of our society, not just the Grateful Dead society, but society at large, because he only made positive contributions to the world, Jerry Garcia. He didn't make people mad. He didn't piss people off. He didn't go out of his way to lie or stir up a group. I mean, that man had, if he wanted to run for public office, he could have had millions of people moving at his beck and call. But that's not what he was about. He was just about a guy who wanted to make everybody happy, and he did. And, you know, I could say thank you for the rest of my life and it wouldn't make a difference. And I have been saying thank you for all of my life up to this point. And I'll continue to do so. These shows that we do and talk about Jerry, you know, on some level may be the most important stuff we do about the Grateful Dead all year, and just really force everyone for a minute to get back to this basic underlying notion of who he was and what he meant. Any parting words, Rob?
No, that was really well said, Larry. And, you know, again, I think it's a great way to end our show, as was always a fitting way to end theirs. And I think that, you know, when you curate your slower songs for an encore, it's usually because, you know, the exciting ones are always easy to do because it leaves everyone euphoric, right? But, you know, playing a slow encore is tougher and it normally comes with some sort of reflection. And, you know, I think Rope Down certainly has it. And I think that's why, you know, the Fare Thee Well shows ended with, you know, Broke Down Palace as the final song they played to say this is it. It's a sense of finality.
Absolutely. Well said. In 1 second here, we're going to sign off. We're going to ask Dan to play that for you guys on the way out so you can sit and listen and maybe have a tear run down your cheek as well. Thank you to Dan Humiston, as always, for a great job of producer. Rob, thank you so much. Love talking with you about all this stuff, and your input is very timely and important and very much appreciated. And to all of our listeners out there, enjoy. I hope you've enjoyed the days between. Keep listening to the Grateful Dead. Enjoy your cannabis responsibly. And please enjoy this final clip. Thank you. We'll talk to you next week.
Rock my soul. Thank you. Good night.